You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Hi, folks. Be sure to visit my website at dr-history.com for a short personal video message, to listen to the latest stories, and to leave a comment.
Well, it's time for Dr. History, and Dr. History is brought to you by our dear friends at Burley Veterinary Hospital with Dr. Scott Morley. He did a great job on the radio last week. His friendly, knowledgeable staff working on the big animals and the small animals, they take care of all of them. They are your family veterinarian, and they're located at 2869 Overland in Burley. The telephone number to call, 678-5509. Burley Veterinary Hospital. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen, with all of his radiant glory, and I'll turn up his headset so he can hear. Can you hear?
I've got to turn it down.
Well, now you got to turn it down. Are you ever satisfied?
That's perfect.
Okay. Good morning, Dr. History.
Good morning, Zeb.
Ay, ay, ay.
So, a couple of people to thank, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this name properly. Akin Genya, from Ankara, Turkey, Zeb.
Wait a minute.
Turkey.
Ankara, Turkey?
Yeah.
They're listening to us right now.
Probably.
Can you speak Turkish?
Not even a little bit.
Just say the common international word, no.
No. No comprendo. So
well, that's
anyway,
nice. How did they get a hold of you?
Well, just through the, somehow through the podcast.
Oh,
and,
my goodness.
But anyway, so they commented about last week. I talked about John Coulter, and they said that Coulter actually landed in Missouri. He got married, and he was approached by the John Jacob Astor expedition.
Well, that's the guy that wrote the song John Jacob Jangleheimer.
No, Zip.
I see.
John Jacob Astor expedition. They invited him to go along, but he didn't want to. He'd had enough.
Well, I can imagine after he had to run naked through the thorns.
Right. And he actually died of jaundice.
He did?
Yeah.
At what age?
I don't know the age exactly, but I think he was in his 60s.
Some of those mountain men didn't live very long.
No, I'm thinking he was in his 60s.
I see.
But I also want to thank Bobby. He wrote to me, and we talked about the National Anthem program that I did several years ago, and I had come across some information about the National Anthem, and I used it on the show, but I didn't know where I got the information or who
they
said
sent
this.
It to you?
And so anyway, we did some research, and we think possibly it was from Paul Harvey Jr., but we're still not sure.
Okay.
So anyway, I'm trying to give credit for where I get some of my information. So
absolutely. So, you don't want to plagiarize anything.
Right. And today's show comes information from the Internet and from Time Life Books.
Wow.
So I have to use a lot of different resources, magazines, books, and the Internet for the show. And so I don't want to play.
Do you have a big library at home?
Oh, I have a huge library.
Is it more organized than what I have here?
Zeb, mine's in alphabetical order.
Oh,
I can go to find that book just like that.
You're serious?
I am.
You're making a mockery out of me.
Well, you do have a menagerie in here.
I, too, can go and find a book if you give me 3 days.
Give you enough time. So we're going to continue with, this is part two of the Trailblazers and the Trappers.
Right.
Okay. So when we finished last week, we talked about Manuel Lisa and John Coulter. And Manuel Lisa eventually died. He actually died in a health spa. But he had a piece in the fur action originating out of St. Louis. Mm. So the next guy to come into play after Lisa was a Virginian. His name was William Ashley. And he took the step of pushing the American fur trade and really the knowledge of the geography of the Rockies and beyond. So with Andrew, he had a partner named Andrew Henry, and Ashley proceeded to organize his own outfit, which became known as the Rocky Mountain Fur Company.
I've heard of that.
And that's a fairly well-known.
Didn't they come to Idaho over in the Preston area?
Oh, they came all through this
whole
area.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. But then 1822, Ashley had a newspaper article, and it said that he was soliciting services of, quote, enterprising young men willing to go into the wilderness. So he recruited a pretty good bunch of men that are well-known, Jed Smith, Jim Bridger, Tom Fitzpatrick, Hugh Glass, the Sublette brothers.
Now, wait a minute. Stop on Hugh Glass. He made quite a historical event for himself, didn't he?
He did.
Wasn't he the guy that had to hide out in the dead buffalo and everything?
Okay, well, I'll mention that briefly.
Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, there's a little controversy on that one. But we'll talk a little bit about that. So you had the Sublette brothers. You had a guy named Edmund Rose. And some of these guys were somewhat respectable, but William Sublette, he was serving as a constable. His brother William was only 21 years old, hadn't done much of anything. Jim Bridger was actually an apprentice to a blacksmith, so he really hadn't done much. Anyway, in the spring of 1823, Ashley led these tough but green men. They didn't know much about the West or the Rockies.
They hadn't done that
no,
before.
No, and so there was about 62 of others besides those. They led them out of St. Louis, and they planned to go up the Missouri River to the Yellowstone country, and there they were going to just spread out and do trapping, just spread out two by two or even singly. But on May 30th, they arrived at the river villages of the Arikara Indians near present-day North and South Dakota, the border, and they kind of blundered into a battle between the Indians and the mountain men.
Oh, boy.
And the cause of this fight has never really totally been understood. Only one fact is that the Arikaras had for years been hostile to the white men. More specifically, they had a grudge against some fur traders who had protected two or three Sioux warriors a few weeks earlier. And this was at a time when the Sioux and the Arikaras were bitter enemies. And they didn't like the fur traders protecting the Sioux warriors. So anyway, when Ashley's party arrived, the Arikaras were still in a warlike mood and had some 600 warriors in their village, and Ashley had 70 men.
The odds were even.
A little, yeah. On the morning of June 2nd, the Arikaras attacked Ashley and his group. The Arikaras completely routed the Americans. They killed 12, and the other was forced to leave, to flee. And anyway, Ashley immediately headed back downstream and sent off a plea for help. And in response, there was a guy named Colonel Henry Leavenworth, and he assembled six companies of the infantry, about 200 men. And as the relief force came to be called the Missouri Legion, they proceeded upstream, and by the time they got there, they'd also picked up 700 Sioux allies. So, you know.
So the Sioux Indian tribe sided with the American government.
Right, because they didn't like the Arikaras.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
And then, what, 50 years later, everything changed.
Right. So by now, they had about 1,100 men. But this Colonel Leavenworth was not what you would call a very good commander. After some skirmishing, the Arikaras slipped out of their village at night. And by outfitting and outmaneuvering the trappers and their allies, the Arikaras damaged the prestige among all the river tribes. Anyway, the traditional river routes to the mountains were now closed to fur seekers. And if he still wanted to get into the fur business, his only option was to head directly west, overland, through the Rockies.
Uh-huh.
So in the fall of 1823, Ashley put the survivors of the Arikara defeat on horse and mule back and sent them deep into the Rockies. So this act of simple necessity turned out to be another permanent feature of the new style Western fur business. So moving men's supplies and furs between the mountains instead of along the Missouri River, this is why they did this.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So they had pack trains and wagons. And with so many other developments in the fur trade, it also produced a fresh burst of land exploration. And within a few years, trapping parties led by Tom Fitzpatrick, these guys, they were heading into the remote Wind River country. And this is where they discovered a pass in the Rocky Mountains called South Pass.
If they turned these guys loose and they had no clue what they were doing, because some of them in their former life were blacksmiths and everything else, how did they know what to do?
Well, I don't know, unless it was just learning by experience.
Wow.
You know, but anyway, South Pass is what where the Oregon Trail went.
Yeah.
And so what they explored and found turned out to be a path for the Oregon Trail.
Wow.
So, and as they got into that country, one of the main problems they had were the Blackfoot warriors.
Oh, they were bad dudes.
Yeah, yeah. So in order to keep contact with his far-flung fur brigades and possibly to be sure they would not be tempted into trading with any rivals, Ashley told his men that in July of 1825, he would meet them at Henry's Fork on the Green River with a caravan load of equipment from St. Louis. There, he would pay them off for their previous month's work, pick up their furs, and re-outfit them for the next season, 1825-1826. And at the same time, since no trapping was done in the summer, they could just kind of lounge around and not do too much, just rest up during the summer. So most of the fur trapping was done throughout the winter.
Where'd they get all the funding?
Well, he outfitted them.
I see.
Ashley outfitted them, but then when they came in with the furs, he would pay them and then re-outfit them for the coming year.
I see.
So, but Ashley let it be known that if Indians, white freelancers, and employees of other fur companies wanted to sell the furs at Henry's Fork, pick up supplies, and join in the fun and games, they were welcome. And so this is what became known as the Rendezvous. And which, of course, is a mountain man experience. And they had it usually at different places throughout every year. Like they had it at Fort Hall, Jackson Hole, Pierre's Hole, another place called Horse Creek. So the rendezvous of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company were at different places.
How did they
year.
Get the word out to all these mountain men where the rendezvous was going to be? They call them on their cell phone or something?
Probably, but you know, they didn't always have service. So I'm thinking that the year that they had the rendezvous, maybe he said, okay, next year we're going to meet at Jackson Hole.
I see.
Or, you know, I don't know, unless word just spread, you know.
Communication in those days was far better than what it is today, I think.
Exactly, yeah. But the American trappers had explored the mountains of the West, from the eastern slopes of the Rockies to the Sierras, with California, to the Columbia River, I mean, to the Mojave Desert. They traveled a long distance. They were the first men in the Badlands of the Great Basin, Yosemite, the Redwoods.
And so they brought all their furs to this rendezvous.
Right, yeah. But they had to travel, you know, long, long distances. And now you mentioned about Hugh Glass.
Yeah.
So and by the way, folks, if you ever watch the movie The Revenant, that's not the way it happened.
Really?
Yeah.
It's Hollywood.
It is. So Hugh Glass was mauled by a bear. Two men, Jim Bridger and I can't remember the other guy's name. I want to say Tom Fitzpatrick. They were given $60 extra to stay with him until he died. They figured he would just die because he was so badly mauled. Well, after 2 or 3 days, he was still alive. And Bridger, just being a young man, Fitzpatrick, I think that's who it was, talked him into just leaving. But they couldn't just leave him. They had to take his gun, his knife, his blanket, his gear.
Why would they take the necessities that he needed to live?
Because they figured he was going to die. And if they showed up with Ashley and they didn't have all of his gear, they say, where's his gear? He's dead, right?
Oh.
You see? So, anyway, Glass, he was not very happy with those two men.
Well, imagine that.
And his goal in life was to catch them and kill them.
Yeah. Well, that was part of the movie, wasn't it?
Yes, but he never killed either one. He didn't kill Bridger or Fitzpatrick.
Oh.
And he didn't have this big fight at the end of the movie. Like I say, that was... Don't even pay attention to the movie.
Okay.
Anyway, moving on to Jim Bridger. Now, he liked to boast that he was the first to discover the Great Salt Lake.
Yeah.
And he was. One winter night in 1825, they were camped in the Cache Valley, just not too far from the Wyoming border. But two men in the party made a bet that the course of the nearby Bear River, where did it go? So to settle the matter, Bridger ran to the river and he paddled down it, and he came to this big bay, and he tasted the water, and he found that it was salty, and he returned to the trapper's camp to report that he'd come across an arm of the Pacific Ocean.
Oh, boy.
But wouldn't you think that, Zeb? Here's salt water. Yep. I mean, logically, you'd think, okay, this is part of the Pacific. But anyway, finally, they did go down there the next year, and they did find out that it was part of the Great Salt Lake.
Right.
So,
The verification of who found what when, that's pretty hard to verify.
It is. There's a couple of myths out there. One that I discovered just a few weeks back is that, we get the impression that most mountain men were illiterate. In fact, there was only about 13% that were illiterate. The
really?
Rest could read and write and kept journals. Like, for example, Osborne Russell, he kept a journal. There were others that kept journals.
Are some of these journals available on reprints to read?
Yeah. There's a book that I've used quite a bit. It's called Journal of a Trapper by Osborne Russell.
Wow.
And he talks about his experiences. I told you this story a long time ago, Zeb, because you always remind me about it.
Yes, I do.
And you don't even know what I'm talking about.
Not really.
Okay. This was the group of men that were up by Henry's Lake, Osborne Russell, and about a dozen or 20 other trappers. And they came around by Henry's Lake, and they were attacked by Indians, and they were going to get wiped out. But one old French trapper took off all of his clothes.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, I knew you'd remember. So he jumped up and he started yelling and screaming.
And they thought he was nuts.
Yeah, they thought he was crazy. And he started charging towards the Indians.
So he was nuts.
And he charged towards them. And the other trappers jumped up and they started running. And the Indians just left.
Well, how would you feel?
Yeah, I mean, this was, I talked about John Coulter, how, he wrote about his experience, or somebody wrote about his experience.
How come all your mountain men stories, everybody's running around naked?
I don't know. Oh. It's just something I seem to go to. But anyway, there's a lot of stories about these mountain men that are recorded by themselves. And another myth I found out is that typically when you see a mountain man, a picture of a mountain man, he has a big long beard, right?
Yeah.
Long hair. Not so. These men, they a lot of times were clean shaven, because if you think about it, about lice and ticks and things like that.
Yeah.
And, so basically they cleaned themselves up fairly regularly.
Did they use a Bowie knife to shave with?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But they could have had some kind of a razor, one of those old razors that they that you see the old barbers use.
You and I have talked about this, and I'm plumb serious when I mention this. They being the mountain men, must have had the most tremendous sense of direction
right.
for the map making and everything they did. I'm amazed.
Yeah. And they were tough. They were, for example, I remember one story where three mountain men were caught in a blizzard, and all they had was a buffalo robe. And they laid the buffalo robe down, and they all laid next to each other in this buffalo robe. But because of the heat from their bodies, it melted the snow. So they were basically laying in water in this buffalo robe. But the comment that one of the men made was that we slept fairly comfortably.
We slept fairly comfortably. I see.
In a buffalo robe in water.
Wow.
So
they didn't have very many social amenities.
No, they didn't. But of course, the rendezvous that we've talked about, that was the time to get together. That was the time when Jim Bridger over at Jackson Hole, Dr. Marcus Whitman was coming through. And Jim Bridger had an arrow in his back.
Oh, I remember this story. Yeah.
He'd been shot. He had two arrows. One was one they got out, but the other arrow was still in his back. And so he just laid down over a log, and
you're making me sweat.
Dr. Marcus Whitman dug that out.
Cut that out.
Yeah.
Of course, he had some ample supplies of adult liquid refreshment.
It doesn't say that.
I see.
But it could have happened.
I see.
The thing that's interesting is there were some other trappers that were watching, and they also had arrows still in them. And so pretty soon he had a lineup of other men wanting to dig out arrows out of their
bodies. If they were up trapping and they broke their legs, they were basically
done. Yeah. And like Hugh Glass, you know, like say, he was just mauled within pretty much dead.
Wow.
But he managed to crawl to a creek where he could get water. He crawled. He found a buffalo or an elk carcass that had been gnawed on by wolves, and he gnawed on it and was able to survive with berries and whatever he could
now,
find.
Now, the misconception of going by themselves, you said, I think on a couple of programs ago, they went like two or three or four more together?
I think it just depends on the situation. You know, some of them may have gone two or three or four together and then maybe split up and then come back and say, okay, we got... Then maybe together they would go back to the rendezvous.
But a broken leg would just be a death wish.
Right. I mean, you were going to get gangrene and infection.
Yeah.
And, I mean, even if you did get back to your partners, the chances of survival would be, you know, pretty much done.
Oh,
and
my.
Same with gunshot wounds. You know, even if it wasn't a fatal wound, the infection and the gangrene would set in to where, you know, you were pretty much done.
Did they have any kind of home remedies for some of that stuff?
You know, the Indians had different herbs and different ways to treat this, different types of poultices.
Yeah.
And so if you could get to an Indian village, a lot of times you could make it. And there were a number of situations where the Indians saved the lives of some of these men with broken legs and with gunshot wounds.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy cow.
So.
Well, you're always interesting. We've got a minute left exactly.
And, you know, I find this pretty interesting, and I'm wondering if maybe we ought to do a part three.
Yeah, now who would be in part three? More of Coulter? Or
No. The next guy that I see here is a guy named Jim Beckwith.
Oh, I know about Jim. He was the first black trapper.
Okay.
Wasn't he?
I
believe he was.
You know, I haven't read far
enough. He was African-American trapper, and I've got a picture of him in my library, of which I can't find, but it's here someplace.
Yeah, well, here, a little further down, I'm just reading, it says, his skin from constant exposure assumes a hue almost as dark as that of the aborigine.
I'm pretty sure he was African-American. I really think he was.
Well, we'll just continue this next
more
week.
More about Jim Beckwith on our next program.
And a little further, we're talking a little bit about Kit Carson.
There you go. He had a TV series.
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty famous.
Hey, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you, and you sound better this week. You're not sick.
No, I'm doing better.
Yeah, you
doing
do a
good.
Lot better. Okay.
Yeah.